Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. We come to you every day with interesting and important stories from around the world. Today, Asia is on our map. First, we try to answer the question, what is next in the Chinese government's efforts against corrupt officials? How high up will the charges go? Then, we talk about a new class of wealthy people in North Korea who make money by lending it to others. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. Recently, former Chinese security chief Zhou Yongkang was tried on corruption charges. He was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. Zhou Yongkang was once one of the most powerful officials in China's government. In addition to his position as chief of public security, he served as head of the Communist Party's Legal and Political Commission. He was also a member of the Politburo Standing Committee, the party's most powerful decision-making agency. David Kelly is the research director at China Policy, a research group in Beijing, the Chinese capital. He says many experts believed because Zhou Yongkang knew the party's deepest secrets, he would never be punished.
How do you take down the former head of the, so to speak, of the KGB or the CIA? This is the guy who knows everything.
Because President Xi Jinping has successfully targeted such a powerful official, some believe he may seek to punish even former heads of the government, including Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin. But other experts say there are already signs that the government may sharply reduce the strength of the campaign. Kerry Brown is an author and the head of the China Studies Center at the University of Sydney in Australia. He says the anti-corruption campaign is likely to continue. He believes it will target people like top aides to former Chinese leaders, but he doubts that former top officials will be tried.
So I don't think that we will see an intensification, but I think we'll see a continuation and a very gradual, kind of lowering of the pressure, as it were.
Mr. Brown says the anti-corruption campaign has been successful for Mr. Xi. He says strengthening it would not be politically useful. In China, there are already signs of changes to the anti-corruption campaign. One day before Zhou Yongkang was sentenced to prison, the Communist Party-controlled People's Daily Newspaper published a report about the campaign. It said the party's top investigating agency may change its approach to corruption. The report said the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection had recently published documents on its website about the anti-corruption campaign. The document said some investigators in the party may be using their powers illegally. They also said investigators should stop targeting top party officials. They said lower-level officials should be punished, but not harshly. Zhou Yongkang was the highest-ranking Communist Party official ever to face charges. But his secret trial and the announcement of his sentence almost a month after the trial ended has confused people in China. David Kelly says many believe the trial is a sign that the anti-corruption campaign is ending.
The heat is off. The political drama that was escalating of resistance to any more of the high-level purges, the political side of the campaign is ebbing, but on the other hand, some more public moves will be made.
Zhang Ming is a political scientist at Renmin University in Beijing. He says because the trial was closed and because Zhou Yongkang was not given either a very strong or a very light sentence, people are uncertain about what will happen next. Zhang Ming says he believes the trial was closed because it included secrets that Chinese officials did not want to release. He says because nothing is known about the trial, it is difficult for observers and officials to predict what will happen to the anti-corruption campaign. He says it is difficult to know if it is ending or for officials to know if they will be targeted. You are listening to VOA, and we are coming to you from Washington. North Korea operates a centrally planned economy, modeled on the governing style of the former Soviet Union. This kind of communism leaves little room for a consumer goods market. But this is beginning to change. North Korea is seeing the rise of a new class of people. This wealthy group called Dunju are creating a middle class in the communist country. Bob Doty has the story.
Dunju means masters of money. The class began to grow following the failure of the country's food distribution system in the 1950s. The Dunju seeks and finds different ways to make money. It runs small businesses and also lends money at high interest rates. Now experts say the Dunju is also increasing its wealth by investing in state building projects. Experts say the North Korean government accepts the Dunju because the government needs money. Im Ul-chul is an Eastern Studies professor at Kyungnam University in South Korea. The expert told a recent conference in Seoul that the North Korean leadership and the Dunju are creating a kind of partnership. The Kim Jong-un regime is utilizing this new class of people to garner its citizens' money in any way possible in order to brag about its economic achievements and to reach its city planning objectives, Mr. Im said. He said that the Dunju has played an important part in major government projects. These include building apartment buildings on Pyongyang's Cheongjeon Street and Munsu Water Park. Andre Lankoff is a Korea expert and professor at South Korea's Kunmin University. He said that North Koreans started to reject official banks in the mid-1990s. That is when the planned economy began to fail. Some observers say it is unlikely that North Korea will ever officially permit private businesses. Reuters reports that the demand for consumer products is on the rise in the North. It says that according to residents and visitors, there is a demand for cosmetics, smartphones, imported fruit juices, and foreign-made clothes. There are a reported 2.5 million wireless phone users in North Korea, out of a population of 24 million. Reuters says many members of the Dunju make money by trading at unofficial markets. They also set up small businesses. Some of these businesses work in partnership with the government. People who have fled North Korea have said those partnerships are very uneven. 70% of the profits go to the government and 30% to the citizens. Just outside Pyongyang, there are small businesses set up that sell coffee at markets and train stations. Some North Koreans also wear jewelry as a sign of wealth and importance in the community. But those who live in Pyongyang say that the economic movement is still very much in its early days. They say a continual energy shortage, repressive government, and severe corruption guarantee slow progress toward change. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. A new report says income inequality is hurting the potential for growth around the world. It says the best way to deal with the inequality, or lack of fairness, is by helping poor people and the middle class. The report is based on an International Monetary Fund study. It examined the issue of income inequality, the differences in wealth between the rich and everyone else. Opinions about income inequality are not hard to find. Many people are concerned about the issue. Kalpana Kochar is Deputy Director of the Strategy, Policy, and Review Department at the IMF. On Monday, she said, the gap between the rich and the poor is at the highest level in decades in advanced countries, and inequality is also rising in major emerging markets. The new report is called Causes and Consequences of Income Inequality, a Global Perspective. Ms. Kochar said inequality trends have been mixed in emerging markets and developing countries. Some countries are experiencing falling inequality rates, with poor people and the middle class making gains. However, pervasive inequalities in education, health care, and finance remain in areas such as Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa. The report suggested that policymakers direct their attention on the poor and middle class. That is because they are the major force for economic growth, or an increase in a country's gross domestic product, or GDP. The GDP is the value of all the finished goods and services produced within the country. The organizers of this study disputed the main idea of what has been called trickle-down economic theory. The theory states that economic benefits provided to the wealthy will indirectly help everyone else. The idea is that money and other financial resources will trickle down to them. The IMF study, however, shows the opposite is true. It found that a 1% increase in the earnings of the richest 20% of people led to a nearly 1% decrease in GDP growth over a 5-year period. An increase in the income share of the poorest 20%, the study found, led to more than a 1/3% increase in GDP. Kalpana Kochar said, this means that directing policy to the poor and middle class is good for growth. She said, this means that ending poverty could also improve growth prospects for all. She said that is a fairly powerful message for policymakers and researchers around the world. The report said there is no single program that will succeed in all countries. It said the difference in income levels can have different reasons. The report urged governments to find ways to solve the problem that are specific to their own countries and institutions. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is Stan Busby.
And this is Rich Kleinfeld with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States.
...1968 was a presidential election year in the United States. It was also one of the saddest and most difficult years in modern American history. The nation was divided by disputes about civil rights and the war in Vietnam.
President Lyndon Johnson had helped win major civil rights legislation. Yet he had also greatly expanded American involvement in the war in Vietnam. By early 1968, it was almost impossible for him to leave the White House without facing anti-war protesters. Johnson wanted to run for another 4-year term, but his popularity kept dropping as the war continued. He understood that he no longer had the support of a majority of the people. In March, he announced that he would not be a candidate.
One reason Johnson decided not to run was a senator from Minnesota, Eugene McCarthy. McCarthy competed against Johnson in several primary elections. The primaries are held months before a political party holds its presidential nominating convention. Delegates to the convention often are required to vote for the candidate their party members chose in the primary. Thousands of college students helped the McCarthy campaign before the primary election in New Hampshire. They told voters all over the state that their candidate would try to end the war. McCarthy received almost 42% of the votes in New Hampshire. Johnson received less than 50%. For a president in office, the vote was an insult.
After McCarthy's success, Senator Robert Kennedy of New York decided to enter the campaign, too. He was a brother of President John Kennedy, who had been murdered in 1963. Robert Kennedy had served as Attorney General, the nation's highest legal officer, in his brother's administration. Many people were pleased when Robert Kennedy announced his decision. They liked his message. He said, "I run to seek new policies to end the bloodshed in Vietnam and in our cities. I seek to lessen the differences between black and white, between rich and poor, between young and old, in this country and around the world."
On April 4, 1968, the nation's top civil rights leader, Martin Luther King, was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Robert Kennedy spoke about King's death to a crowd of black citizens.
"What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another. and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
No words, however, could calm the anger of America's black community. Martin Luther King had led the civil rights movement with peaceful methods. Yet his death led to violence in almost 130 cities in America. Soldiers were called to crush the riots. Hundreds of people were killed or injured. After the riots, another man decided to campaign for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. The new candidate was Vice President Hubert Humphrey. Traditional Democrats supported him.
The primary elections continued. Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy tried to show how different they were. Many voters, however, saw little difference between their positions on major issues. Both men opposed the war in Vietnam. Both sought social reforms. Both sought improvement in civil rights in America. Kennedy defeated McCarthy in primaries in Indiana and Nebraska. McCarthy defeated Kennedy in Oregon. The next big primary was in California. Kennedy said that if he did not win this important contest, he would withdraw. He won.
Perhaps Robert Kennedy might have won his party's nomination for president. Perhaps he might have defeated the Republican Party candidate in the national election. The nation would never know. Kennedy made his California victory speech at a hotel in Los Angeles. As he was leaving the hotel, he was shot. He died a few hours later. The man who shot him was Sirhan Bishara Sirhan. He was a Palestinian refugee. He said he blamed Robert Kennedy for the problems of the Palestinians.
The nation's two major political parties held their nominating conventions in the summer of 1968. The Republicans met first. It was soon clear that Richard Nixon would control the convention. Nixon had run for president in 1960. He lost to John Kennedy. 8 years later, he won several primary elections. He was a strong candidate to win the Republican nomination again. The other candidates were Ronald Reagan, governor of California, and Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York. On the first ballot, Nixon got more than two times as many votes as Rockefeller. Reagan was far behind. Most of the delegates then gave their support to Nixon, and he accepted the nomination. The delegates chose the governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew, to be their vice presidential candidate.
The convention of the Democratic Party was very different from the convention of the Republicans. The Democrats were the party in power. Protests against the war in Vietnam were aimed at them. Thousands of anti-war protesters gathered in the city of Chicago during the political convention. The city's mayor, Richard Daley, had ordered the police to deal severely with all protesters. Many of the young people were beaten. Much later, the federal government ordered an investigation. The report said that the riots in Chicago were a result of the actions of the police themselves.
Inside the convention building, the delegates voted for their presidential candidate. They did not choose the man who had done so well in the early primary elections, Eugene McCarthy. Instead, they chose the more traditional candidate, Hubert Humphrey. For their vice presidential candidate, they chose Edmund Muskie, a senator from Maine.
The two men running for president, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, supported American involvement in Vietnam. Yet during the campaign, both spoke about finding ways to end the conflict. Both also spoke about finding ways to end social unrest in the United States. Many voters saw little difference between the two candidates. About 6 weeks before Election Day, public opinion studies showed that the contest was even.
Nixon's major problem was his past. He had made enemies during his early political life. These people now tried to renew public fears about his record as a man who made fierce, unjust attacks on others. Vice President Humphrey's major problem was that he was vice president. He had to defend the administration's policies, even the unpopular ones. If he said anything that was different, another member of the administration intervened.
Once, for example, Humphrey said the United States would stop dropping bombs on North Vietnam. But President Johnson did not act for a month. He gave the order to stop only 4 days before the election. Later, Humphrey said the delay harmed his campaign so badly that he could not recover from the damage.
On Election Day, Richard Nixon won, but not by much. He received a little more than 43% of the votes. Hubert Humphrey received just 0.5% less. Nixon was about to become president. It was the position he had wanted for a long time. It was to be a presidency that would change American government for years to come.
This program of The Making of a Nation was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Stan Busby. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States.